The 2024 Banking with Life Client Only event is coming up this October, Friday the 25th, Saturday the 26th. I'm excited to see you, excited to share the news with you.
How many people were there last year?
A little over 130.
How many states?
22 to 23.
Yeah. Okay. So right. the only kind of event where you've got the minority, really the minority, right? Y'all see what's going on social media and online with how IBC and the language of banking is being used. You know that what you're doing is different, and there is one opportunity in the year to go hang out with a bunch of other people who are all doing something very similar. I don't think you should miss it.
You shouldn't miss it. I mean, it's going to be full of educational talks, you know, breakfast, lunch. The details will be forthcoming in an email, gives you the opportunity to register. And so I don't want to get deep into the details, but I'm telling you, a room full of like-minded people that are not ashamed to be paying premium, actually controlling the banking function. And last year, Ryan, we had clients that were maybe a month or two brand new clients, mm-hmm. and clients that were 10 or 12 years practicing.
Yeah.
So there's a broad array of people from all over the country doing different things, mm-hmm. but they're all focused on controlling the banking function in their life properly, correctly.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. That's a big deal. I don't know where you can go and find that many people in one room.
Yeah. And had the opportunity to hear directly from number one, number two, I mean, senior executive leadership at a company that a lot of our clients own. You know, in what other domain of finance today does that ever happen? And nobody go and meet the head of some index fund, okay, or the guys who write up the 401k plans. But you get that here. You hear directly from the people who work at and are in charge of the companies themselves. You meet other people, like you said, brand new clients, people who've been doing it for over a decade. None of this. Look, there's plenty of places. You want to go do the crypto. You want to go do the real estate investing and do into the new flashy, fun things that are really great to sell you right down a river. There's a lot of that out there. People have a lot of opportunity to go do that. This is not that. It's a nice little break from that. If you were there last year, you know, the venue was very nice. It's a great time to be in Texas in October. I enjoyed it. You know, it'll be a good time.
Ryan's book will be out, the opportunity to get it autographed, other new merch. I'm looking forward to it. You know, the first one, this will be the third one. The first one was really good. You know, 100 people there, 20 different states. More people were there last year in the second one, more states. I think this one is going to be bigger and better, regardless of how many people come. I'm excited about the talks and the people talking. Yeah. The team will be there. You'll be able to get to meet them. I know most of you have, a lot of you have met them, and all of you, all of our clients have spoken with them, but to be able to meet them is, it's a great opportunity.
Former podcast guests, you know, they come.
Oh yeah.
It's for clients of James Nethery and for my clients. And again, details will be in the email. Sign up will be through email. Last time we had a lot of questions about where's the link? It'll be provided by email. Okay, there is no public page because it's not for the public. It'll be sent directly to you. All right.
Yeah, the only agents that'll be there will be zero outside agents, but there are agents that are affiliated with my office and they'll be there and they're clients. Yeah. And it's not a sales fest. You know, it's not come and see the next great thing to, you know, be pressured into purchasing before you have a birthday or whatever.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty cool. Calm, cool, relaxed, and educational and fun. Yeah. Did I mention fun? Yeah, it'll be fun. I assure you. Okay. Hope to see you there.
See you there.
In this episode, Ryan and I discuss the cumulative effect of the many design elements typically found in the online noise. We had fun, and I hope you enjoy listening. Welcome to the Banking with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery.
I'm your co-host, Ryan Griggs.
It's been a minute, Mr. Griggs. It's good to see you, sir.
Yeah.
Probably traveling the world again. I don't know.
No, trying to keep my nose to the grindstone and work on things that I should be working on rather than getting all fired up over the nonsense out there. I know people who have been watching lately and shared comments both on the platform and with James directly and then also with me noticing that I've been a little fired up lately. So I would like to acknowledge that. There have been this for I don't know about the timing. You know, we've talked about bits about why, you know, the book published in 2000, the Nelson Nash Institute, 2012, 2013, you know, this podcast is, I'm going to keep saying it because I know it just sticks in their craw, but the oldest running podcast on the infinite banking concept. And we're just over the 5-year mark. So
are we really?
Yeah. 2019 as we started. Yeah. So here we are, 2024. So just over the 5-year mark, you know, still relatively young, relatively new. So then you've got the other, you know, the onslaught of the marketing. You know, people start to figure out that a life license is fairly easy to get. And then the companies will hand out, certain companies will hand out the contracts like candy. And then there's the second level of it, which is the marketing machine, right? The online internet marketers figured out that people are selling life insurance and they need help with the marketing too. And so you can build these, you know, whether it's the click funnels, you know, the back end structure, or it's the thumbnails or whatever aspect of the conventional marketing thing that you see in all the other industries. But that's now getting into life insurance. Yeah. And so this brings with it a greater quantity of eyeballs of people interested. Mm-hmm. And many of them, probably the majority, frankly, find the people who pay to be seen.
Sure.
Which is what first that is. And so they end up with the kinds of policies built the kind of way that we've criticized for a long time.
With criticism.
And then, you know, people want to have what they've done validated. So you get the online groups where people start sharing and then, well, you know, this is what so-and-so is saying. No, this is what the other person's saying. This is what I've done. What have you
done? Why are they arguing?
Yeah, let's compare, you know, forget what the people are saying, right? Let's just look at the numbers because the numbers speak for themselves. Let's look at the illustration, right, with the depicted numbers that all rely on many assumptions, none of which are ever really fully talked about. And then so you get these conversations comparing the numbers on the page and he's wrong and he's right. And then it's starting to get to the point now where people's identities are kind of bound up in this stuff. And so now you're challenging like someone's character. If you're coming at, you know, from if you have a professional disagreement that's interpreted as like this slant against who somebody is. So it all gets very intense and nasty, kind of like politics does, right? Very difficult to just have professional differences. And then at the end of the day, you know, what really ends up triggering me and the reason for the timing in particular has been, as we were talking about before we started recording, we've started to hear from some of these people who started down that path, who are now neck deep in the consequences of it, right? They've got the very small base premium type policies. They were told that they could just pay this big old premium for a year, maybe 2 years, and then they could start taking policy loans to pay the premium just forever. And that was going to work out.
With an income.
Yeah. And then this was supposed to then support them late in life in quote unquote retirement, you know, their golden years, passive cash flow time. And it's like layer upon layer upon layer of error. And here we are, and I'm thinking of one person in particular, here we are 8 years later, you know, 8 years from when these decisions were made to buy these policies in this way. You know, these people, we're starting to hear from the people who were essentially like the first movers, you know, the people who were first attracted to the small base, large PUA, loan it out forever type mentality. And so they're now the first ones who are discovering the practical long-term consequences of that kind of activity. And so they're contacted, and it's a horror show. You know, people have to now reconsider, you know, they were going to retire at 65 or 62 or say, or whatever. Got to rethink that. No, need to retire later. Need more cash flow. Can't pay the premium and the policy loan interest on this policy. Got to get rid of the policy. Right? What's that look like? What's a life settlement transaction look like? Who do you go to for that? Oh, there is no marketplace for it. It's got to be decided eyeball to eyeball, person to person. Right? So there's a whole other field of uncertainty, and what do I do there? And then there's the psychological and emotional anguish that comes with all of that. And so, yeah, that irritates me. And it's hard to hold that in, you know?
There's an awful lot there. So I think we're ultimately going to, you know, and we are, not ultimately, we are, and we're going to continue speaking on the cumulative effect of all of these elements that, you know, I've railed on for a long time. We've railed on for a long time, 5 years, you know. But I want to go back to the comments, you know. Like, I think that three-part series is where, you know, some of the drive-by comments were, and we'll discuss those on another episode.
I haven't seen them, so
I didn't want to show him before the camera turned on. But there are many more positive comments, you know, and we have both experienced over the last month the result of what he's speaking of, and we'll discuss some of those. But I want to say, early on, you know, the Nelson Nash Institute started in 2013, okay? You know, Nelson Nash putting his think tank together, I think I only missed the first two, and I was, you know, I showed up somewhere 2004, 2005, and when Nelson Nash held a think tank, there were agents that would come in, and they would give presentations, you know, much like what continues today. And these Frankenstein policies are not brand new, right? They have existed previously. And I've said it many times, and especially when I talk to clients, you know, mono, one-on-one, or, you know, in client only, there are two ladies up front that comprise our service department. And here we are in 2024, and because of, I mean, I'm not blaming anyone. My name's on them. You know, other agents within, you know, affiliated with my office, they drug me off into the wilderness on the 90-10 type construct, right? And here we are 14 years later, and that, of course, that individual is no longer an agent, right? So who are they going to call?
What a surprise.
Right? And then you call the home office, and they just write life insurance on many different, you know, it could be retirement plans, could be, you know, legacy planning, it could be estate planning. You know, the infinite banking concept typically comprises a very small, as a percentage basis, of their overall business. Do you think there's a quote-unquote infinite banking expert in the home office of the life insurance company you own? It's a valid question that you should consider, and I say I think not. Are they aware of it? Sure, they go on YouTube and watch all these videos as well, or as much as they want.
They think it's great. Look at all this lead generation.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so at one time, up until very recently, the two ladies in my office, 60% of their service work was preventing those policies, those types of policies, from becoming MECs, just trying to keep them together, keeping the people between the lines, what have you. Not even originally my clients. You know, I'm not saying my hands are squeaky clean, but they're and you don't even have to experience, you don't have to wait 10 years, right, to see if this culmination of elements that are based in short-term thinking and ignorance are going to blow up on you or not. Common sense and reasoning, you know, thinking, Nelson, rethink your thinking. Think long range. And long range is not 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years. It is not. You know, that man graduated at age 88. I mean, do you think he thought about, not only did he think about his life expectancy or his life, He thought past his life to his children's life, grandchildren's, great-grandchildren, more than one generation. So, you know, we talk about think long range and you're going to go cash on cash at some point in time in the future. That is a data point on an illustration that was manipulated, my opinion, right? Is that long range? No. Oh, no. Oh, but the real estate deal is going by, or crypto's hot right now, or whatever the other revenue source that you got to be focused on to fit into their program there, the big wide world. Anything but discipline and capital accumulation.
Anything but regular savings, regular spending less than you make, and channeling the margin into your own personal monetary system. None of that. None of this building a branch of your banking business, contributing gleefully, willfully to the foundation of it, right? Constructing things, designing the policy in such a way so that you can predictably, reliably contribute a substantial premium for a very long time. There's none of that. Right, the emphasis online nowadays, and it's more and more of it. It's, like I said earlier, it's the majority. You know, the paid viewership out there, the majority view is that you should squish the base premium down as close to zero as possible. That it doesn't matter whether the policy is treated with direct or non-direct recognition, and there's really no attention paid to the type of term rider. If there is one, there ordinarily is one. And so the type of term rider ends up being 1 year term. Or maybe, if you're lucky, a very short dated level term, like a 7 year term rider.
Maybe 10 if you're really thinking long term, right?
Yeah. Whatever that agent was taught by whoever originated that particular lead generation system.
And then they learn maybe, but most of the ones that really get up there and show the illustration, you know, and get into what appears to be an educational, authoritarian dissection of an illustration, you know, those, they have learned to manipulate the life insurance company's software. So when I say Frankenstein, I know that's a very broad Frankenstein policies. Well, man, Frankenstein was raised from the dead.
And this is especially with my interest in like economic methodology. I mean, the idea that if I hold up a page or we put a graphic on the screen that has numbers on it, I mean, that carries, like it or not, in contemporary culture, that carries this allure, this veneer, this facade of expertise and authority. Yeah. Like, look, this isn't me. This is from a company. You know, it's got numbers on the page. It says the life insurance company's name up there. Look at that. And then, you know, to their brilliant credit, Wall Street, look, this number here is bigger than that number over there. Ooh, look, you should do it. You know, that approach, it's so appalling to me because it is so misleading, right? And how much of all of that online, you go read, I'm sure everybody's done this, right? Go read your state's insurance code will have a deceptive and unfair trade practices section somewhere. All of it's based on National Association of Insurance Commissioners model regulation. Every individual state insurance commission has adopted some version of it. All of them look fairly similar. All of it's public information. You can compare across states. All of them have some sort of language talking about the intent behind what's being done. Right. So now I'm not the police. We don't mention names on here. I'm not a rat. Right. But I'm just pointing out to you the nature of things that exist for that you can go see for yourself. Okay. A lot of this material is misleading. And the particular way in which it is misleading has to do with this. Oh, look, don't take my word for it. I'm showing you numbers and the numbers speak for themselves. No, they don't. Okay. One has to understand the quality of the numbers, the source of those numbers? What assumptions go into those numbers? And then, and this is the part that is more difficult, you know, it's very easy to show numbers and say, look, ooh, one's bigger than the other. That's a lot that you know, you compress so much into this, you know, dry numerical comparison. And you leave out the much more difficult task of reasoning through the underlying assumptions, right? And look, we've treated a lot of these different particular elements, you know, the idea of having a very small base premium, the idea of having direct versus non-direct recognition, the idea of having a different, you know, one kind of term writer versus the other, the idea of having a relatively restrictive PUA writer, right? The idea of being able to pay PUA premium on a unscheduled or discretionary basis as opposed to a scheduled one. We've treated each of these different things at a lot of different places at a lot of different times throughout this podcast. One thing that we've not emphasized as much is that a lot of these elements often go together, right? And that and the consequence of the cumulative consequence of combining these various unfavorable elements together have their own additional negative impact, right? So just for example, if you have an annually renewing term rider on the policy where at the time of issue, right, when the policy is applied for and then when it goes in force at that time of issue, when that policy is illustrated, the system has to assume some amount of temporary death benefit to be in force on this annually renewing term rider each year in order that there can be numbers on the page, right? There's got to be some underlying assumption there. Well, that amount of temporary term death benefit that will last with these annually renewing term riders for 1 year and hence annually renewing, that assumed amount of death benefit in force on that term rider each year is imputed, it's calculated from an assumed stream of future dividends. And future dividends are depicted on the page based on the current experience of the company, which means experience that will change, and based on the assumed premium payments that you pay the premiums as shown on the page on time, just exactly as shown. And then very often, in fact, virtually always, if the policy is treated with direct recognition, virtually never does the agent produce an illustration that assumes outstanding policy loans.
What? Well, if they do, the ones that I've seen are much later showing passive income.
Yes, they're shown later.
Very much later, 20, 30, 15 years, whatever. And so... And if you think that through, okay, you, young individual, you're going to purchase this your policy and you want to embrace the infinite banking concept and you want to become your own banker, that assumes that there is going to be financing between then and that future exactly. passive income.
So, yes. So if you're actually using the policy to become your own banker, which is ostensibly the point, right? So the idea is that you will take policy loans. You will carry a loan balance from one policy year to the next. There will be an outstanding policy loan balance at the end of that policy date. The dividend paid actually, in reality, in the future, in those future policy years, when you do have outstanding policy loans, when the policy is treated with direct recognition, those dividends will be lower than was originally assumed when the policy was illustrated. A lower than illustrated dividend, I say a dividend that in actuality diverges from what was originally assumed, that smaller dividend will now mean less PUA premium paid to the policy from the dividend, and therefore less death benefit will be purchased by the dividend in that policy year. And if the actual dividend, again, in reality, in the future, does diverge, we're saying in part because we're assuming, but a reasonable assumption, that you actually have a policy loan balance outstanding, that direct recognition will kick in, that the dividend will in fact be smaller, that there will be less PUA paid from the dividend, that the death benefit purchased from that PUA from the dividend will be lower. Well, now, for your annually renewing term rider, the amount of death benefit that must come on that rider in order to maintain the preferable non-mech status is going to be higher. How much higher? Who knows? Okay, who knows? And it's not up to you, and it's not up to the agent. It's going to be up to the company. And it's not as though you get, there's not like an appeals court where you can challenge them and say, oh, how much of this? No, no. They send you a letter and they tell you this is how much more you're going to need, and or this is how much more in premium you need to pay for this one policy year to keep the amount of annually renewing term death benefit we say you need in order that you can achieve that target death benefit that you need in order to maintain the non-mech status while you continue paying that big old high illustrated premium. Okay. Now that's a long train of thought that a lot of people aren't going to be interested in or haven't heard or won't keep up with. And so what will happen very often, and what we have seen happen, and what, and there will be more of this happening, is that that higher annually renewing term premium won't be paid. And you don't have to pay it. Again, this is why they say you have all this flexibility and all these. Okay, sure. You don't have, look, you don't have to do anything. A whole life insurance policy is a unilateral contract that you own. There's not a, you're not bound to do anything, right? But insofar as you want to do certain things, insofar as you'd like to keep the policy, insofar as you'd like to continue to be able to pay a high PUA premium, insofar as you'd like to pay that premium for a very long time, insofar as you'd like to have a lot of cash value, death benefit, and dividend growth over time, insofar as those things are true, well, then you do need to do certain things, one of which in this type of construct will be to pay that higher premium. And of course, for that annually renewing term rider. And again, these riders annually renew. And so this will happen every year. And oh, by the way, cash value growth occurs in this compounded vacuum, right? We're manufacturing, we're engineering future growth. We're taking advantage of this present valuation relationship between the cash value and the future death benefit. This is what allows companies and agents to refer to this idea of ongoing compounded growth. Well, in compounded growth processes, future growth depends on the degree of prior growth. So if this little scenario that I've been walking through happens in 1 year, it will necessarily affect all future years. If the dividend is lower in 1 year, if the amount of permanent death benefit purchased by PUA from the dividend is less than was originally illustrated, well, then all future death benefits and dividends on that policy will be lower than originally illustrated because of the one deviation in 1 year. And then that means necessarily due to that one deviation, the amount of term death benefit on that annually renewing term rider will need to be greater in all future years. Now, someone could come back and say, oh, but if dividends come back up and if PUA, yeah, if things were different, they'll be different, right? But I'm talking about if just as it's for all else equal, right? Just considering this one change, there will, because of the way cash value grows, because of its compounded growth nature, because it occurs as a result of this present valuation idea and not because we're relying on some outside indice or something. A change in 1 year necessarily implies changes in future years. And so these problems will also compound. Now, how much of that is taken into consideration in the fly-by-night, just look at the numbers on the page sales presentation? None of it. Let's be honest. None of it. Right? So what is the practical effect of all of this? The practical effect is what happens in that policy, the 1090, you know, anti-base, direct recognition, annually renewing term rider, what happens in that policy in reality is that it'll look nothing like what was originally illustrated. If you take into consideration the practical, very likely things that are to happen in the policy, like company experience in reality deviating from what was originally assumed, like you not paying premium exactly on time, exactly in the amount as illustrated when illustrated, like you carrying a policy loan balance on a direct recognition treated policy from one policy year to the next. If any of those very reasonably likely things happen, then what's illustrated on the page is just made up. It's just mythical. It's just sales material. It's just probably deceptive and misleading. And so, yeah, that irritates me. And so when you compound it, by the agent who comes along and says, oh, look, not in this book, not in the black book, but in another book that happens to have Nelson's name on it. When people say, oh, look, you know, I've been told by authority figures that I can just start taking policy loans and I can basically do premium financing using the company's money. I can start taking policy loans and just pay the premium forever and it'll be fine. And the cash value growth, because it's compounding, will be greater than the rising loan balance. And that in the future, I'll just take care of that loan balance because I don't make my money in the policy. I make my money outside the policy. I'm going to go buy the cash flowing real estate that always goes up and up forever. I'm going to go be my, you know, expert crypto investor because I pay for the special newsletter that's going to tell me how to do things that other people don't, right? I'm going to go do all these wonderful, great things, and they're all going to work out. And the proceeds from all of that will all go make better this whole insurance thing. All that assumed future cash flow will take care of this rising loan balance, right? It's like, I don't know what that is, but it's not financial advising.
It's profitable for someone.
And it is these life insurance companies cannot help themselves, but send around to other agents the sales figures, right? So I see what they sell. And you know who I'm talking about. You see this stuff online, okay? We see their numbers. It works for now. It works for now. Sales will be made. And as time goes on, these consequences will become manifest, and more people are going to find themselves with policies that are performing in no way, shape, or form as they were originally sold. It gets worse if the agent also made numbers up and put them on an Excel sheet and fabricated some arithmetic in order to convince you to say yes. And then the years will go by. And just like the conventional financial planner who says, oh, the market went down this year. Well, it's okay. You know, just wait. Just wait it out. It's not timing the market. It's time in the market. You know, it'll be in the future. And then you wake up one day and you're 60 or you're 70 and you say, well, I don't have much more time to figure this out. I don't have much more time for the market to come back. Well, people who do insurance this kind of way, who are going to go participate in some other market correlated asset, that's always inevitably connected to the fractional reserve banking system and the business cycle, will find themselves up a creek much older than they were when they started all of this. But hey, like you said before, James, you know, the agent got paid, companies collected that premium, you know, and 2 out of 3 ain't bad. You know, and who's the third? Do you want to?
You know, as always, there is a lot there. And I want to say that, and you covered most of them. There are still some other elements that you might not have touched on. And it's the culmination and the combination of all of these elements. And then over time, right, it could be great the first year, you know, I collateralized whatever I own and had the ability to probably to the maximum or whatever my comfort level is, and then take that premium and buy a policy and collateralize the policy to get the cash flowing asset ideal, the greatest, hottest, you know, product that is being promoted. And that's as if nothing will ever. There's an awful lot of assumptions that go on there. Then you're just compounding. But
yeah,
I mean, it's, you know, we all have an exponential curve in our life, right? All of these elements that are combined, they also have an exponential curve. And the further out they go, the worse they get. I have seen, and I want to kind of go back to the comments. There are positive comments. And some of the positive comments that has been shared with me over the last couple of weeks was the amount of appreciation, which we get them regularly, and I greatly thank you for your encouragement and your positive, you know, comments and encouragement. Thank you. I know that agents listen. I know that a lot of clients listen. I know that a lot of people that are not our clients listening, and I appreciate all the comments. I just appreciate the positive ones, you know, better, of course. But recently, I've had several comments from people who are not my clients that have been doing this for either 2 or 3 years or 7 or 8 years. And, you know, of course, the podcast didn't exist 7 or 8 years ago. I mean, I had some online videos out there, but they didn't know anything about infinite banking, or they got started and didn't know, you know, what all they didn't know, of course. And typically I don't, but I received an email and said, does James ever review policies? You know, we started these a long time ago. The agent didn't really know anything about infinite banking. And so I agreed. And I'm not saying they're good or bad. Another example of a positive email that I received, and there was some other positivity to that email, was a gentleman that right in the middle of the quote-unquote buying process, you know, recently, and because he has listened to this podcast without, and we don't go straight into detail and cover, you know, some of these things, some that many things all in one 25-minute period, and he's listened to several, and he just expressly thanked. He said, James, thank you. Thank Ryan for doing the podcast, putting it out there, making it available. I've consumed, you know, a certain amount of it, which was quite a bit, if not all, going through the second time. And he said, because of what I've learned on that podcast, I have gone back to the agent and that he's working with and restructured. I didn't talk to him. He's already done all that. He's informing me and expressing the appreciation of what he's actually learned. So he knows what he's doing could be better and why. Mm. Right? So we didn't blow up their business or anything like that. You know, as a thank you for the positive comments. Yeah. But then, you know, recently too, I've heard comments. It's like, I don't have the attention span to listen to an hour long podcast. I don't have the time. I don't, whatever the excuse is, heard it several times. You know, recently I've heard him, you know, more previously, I don't have the time. Perfect. Okay. I mean, I don't sit down here. You don't drive down here to sit down here and look at a clock and say, oh, let's cut a 15-minute reel. You know, and here's everything that we're going to talk about. Now, we did have a conversation before we turned the mics on and the cameras on. And, you know, is there anything you want to talk about? And typically it's something that's occurred or you've experienced and, you know, we feel like it would be beneficial to discuss. If you don't have the time to learn, like in Nelson's book, Becoming Your Own Banker, if you don't have time for a 30-minute podcast, you sure as hell are not going to make time to set aside time to do a 3.5-4-hour reading. And if you're a slow reader, then I am, then why bother?
Yeah.
You know, so I appreciate the positive comments and I appreciate the fact that people can learn if they want to learn. They have the opportunity in the discipline to go through an hour podcast and get beyond the clickbaity stuff and understand some of the nuances that we discuss. Every podcast, very nuanced, right? Well, you don't want us, I know you don't want me to break it down. You don't want us to break it down so simple and spoon feed it to you, right? Like you're not able to think or you're not intelligent. I mean, that's an insult in my opinion. So thanks for the third or fourth time. I'm an appreciative individual. Thank you for the listening. Thank you for the positive comments. I get them all the time from agents as well. James, I didn't know that. I didn't know this. I didn't know that. Thanks. You know, you're welcome. All right. You're welcome. And thanks for letting me know that you've benefited it to the point where you can benefit others. You know, I believe most of the agents and advisors out in the big wide world want to do the right thing for their clients. You know, I mean, I truly believe that. And I don't have angelic intentions. I don't project angelic intentions. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and believe what you say until you prove me wrong. You know, my daddy used to say, I can't hear what you're saying because your actions are too loud. So I'm just saying, thank you. Okay. And I appreciate the positive, and I appreciate the fact that you share the fact that you've learned something that is beneficial to you and to your family, whether you're an individual or an agent, doesn't matter. I'll wrap my little commentary up here with this. There are so many elements. Ryan touched on an awful lot of them. When you put them together, the compounding effect of that over time is not going to serve you well. And so you're either going to go to the bitter end with paying all the maximum premiums, doing the maximum loans, and the future's unknown, and whatever changes occur. I mean, there are books out there written within this space. If you followed those illustrations, there are tragedies in the future. But it's presented that, man, this is a great solution. You can do this. I'll leave it at that. You put all of these together, the compounding effect, if you ride it all the way out, is just going to be a greater tragedy, more fragility. Quite often, though, people get a year or two or 3 years or 4 years into it, and they know there's something wrong in there, and they're not going to continue to go out there to the bitter end.
And let me say this, too. This is a because the people have the negative, little nasty, snarky comments, right? And I had one on my whole life insurance mechanic series. You know, someone's being extraordinarily clever, right? Where's the commissions? And I was talking about cash value growth and how's the present net present value of future death benefit and payment of base premium and interest and PUA from dividends and PUA from the policy owner's own pocket all cause cash value to go up over time. And the little snarky comment is like, so where's the commissions? And it's so revealing, right? It's so revealing. And here's the point. People who disagree with me or who disagree with James, they never, ever meet the argument on the merits.
Ooh.
They'll never say, oh no, you know, the idea that there's this cumulative effect of direct recognition, anti-base, and annually renewing term is wrong for X, Y, and Z. They'll never say, oh yeah, the idea that you have annually renewing term and that future deviations that, you know, diverge from what was originally illustrated could cause future problems and you could be liable for more temporary premium. And if you don't pay that premium, then you're going to have to cut back on your annually renewing. I mean, if you're going to have to cut back on your PUA premium and the future illustrated cash values and death benefits are all the result of a compounded process. And so all those numbers will be much lower if any of that happens. And no, they'll never address any of that, right? It's never, let's address the merits of the argument, right? It's always, oh, he's angry. He's arrogant.
Yeah,
he's fired up. He's a commission hound, right? It's always non sequitur. And so look, you don't even have to accept what I'm saying. You don't have to believe me. You don't have to believe anybody, right? But you can look at the form of the response. They're not even trying to address the argument. And that on its own should be revealing to you. If I'm so clearly wrong, if I'm just a money-grubbing commission hound, then these allegedly weak arguments that I'm bringing up should be easy to demolish for these self-anointed financial entertainment experts. They're so clever. They figured it out so well. They know all the special cash flow hacks out there in the real estate and crypto markets. And they're just, they've fallen into authority and expertise in whole life insurance. My arguments should be easy to dismantle. I put it out there for free. It's been on the Whole Life Insurance Mechanics series for 2 years now. We've had this podcast for 5 years. I've been saying the same things. It's not changed. But no, it's never let's address what he's actually saying. It's, well, base premium pays a higher commission than does PUA. Level term riders pay higher commissions than do annually renewing term riders. All of which is true. But do you know that I'd rather be paid nothing than be paid something that should have been done correctly, that I know isn't being done properly? So what's higher then, Mr. Wall Street bigger number finder? Something or nothing? I turn clients, not clients, I turn people who call me seeking validation for what they find on the financial entertainment channels, I turn them away because it is not worth it to me. This was not the deal I made when I decided, committed fully back in 2019 that I would do this the way that appears right to me or I'll go down in flames. Look, you're dealing with somebody who is spiritually convicted. And so I'll burn it down. I will burn it down. I have no problem. I have family members who have filed for bankruptcy. I have no problem completely failing at this. I really don't. And so that's why. And then you bring in the economic background and knowing Nelson personally and having a personal relationship with James and learning the what's really behind all this. What matters to me affects the kind of arguments I bring to you. And that comes from a place that, yeah, you can't find on a page and you can't put a number on. And so my getting triggered, my being emotional, my getting fired up. Yeah, it bothers me that real life people are negatively affected by this kind of stuff. But you know what? For all those people who leave the nasty little comments and things, y'all just keep it coming. Keep it coming. You are proving my point by whining and complaining and the ad hominem and the non sequitur and all that nonsense. You are illustrating to people your unwillingness to meet what I am arguing. And that on its own should show you, the viewer, the listener, the reader, the student, that should show you something all by itself, that's what they have to resort to. Right? Then they're resorting to that for a reason. Maybe it's their own ignorance. Maybe that ignorance is willful. Maybe they ought to know but don't. Whatever it may be, maybe they've got the angelic intentions and, you know, something is better than nothing. Maybe they've got a condescending attitude about your ability to comprehend things and so they want to make it simple for you. Whatever the reason is, I don't really care. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. And if the majority, you know, there are groups out there who are fixated on getting a certain percentage of people to become their own banker, to do IBC or their version of IBC or to buy whole life and all that. And it's like, yeah, that kind of sounds nice. Again, bigger number, better. Like, yeah, okay, more would be better than less. I get it. I'm not into all that. I don't care. I don't care about the majority. Okay. I care about the one. I care about the one. First of all, the one staring me in the mirror in the morning, number one, I have to be good with him, right? I have to know that what I'm doing as part of my profession that is linked to my mentors and my teachers is right in a way that I believe and that I can reason about. So that's number one. And then I care about the one person on the other end of the phone or on the other end of the email. I couldn't care less about the 10% or the 20% or the 100% or whatever. I don't care. I care about the one. And so long as there are people who are seeking to understand, so long as there are people who actually want to know why one might approach this in certain ways and not others, why might you choose a traditional longer pay policy rather than a limited pay? Why might you not go with one of the big four who's got the big marketing budgets? Why might you choose non-direction instead of direct recognition? Why might you want a long-dated level term writer? Why might you choose to start paying a lower premium than what the guys marketing to you online tell you you can do? Why might that be good for those who want to understand why? I will continue to explain these things. And we will continue to explain these things on this podcast, in the book I have coming out, at the annual event, at the event that we have later this year, the Banking with Life client-only event. We'll continue to do these things this way. And I look forward to more of the nasty, teenage, immature, whining, incompetent complainers going on with their non sequiturs and ad hominem, because it just illustrates my point, my exact point, which is that they're unwilling. And if they were willing, they'd be incapable of meeting the merits of the argument.
Fact. That's a fact. I mean, I'm laughing, but that's a fact. If they were willing, they would be unable. And that's not just a side remark. That's a fact. I do like the efforts from time to time where they bust out more illustrations and they bust out more third-party software.
Yeah. Again, unwilling to meet. I'm telling you, it's not about the numbers on the page. You have to go to the part of that illustration where nobody wants to go to, where there are English words, where the various elements of the policy are explained in words, and you have to address what's there. To go and say, oh, look, Mr. Big Four company, I can show 20 years of maximum premium outlay with a 1090 structure, no problem.
And I've been paying it. They keep taking it.
I've got clients who have bought it. And yeah, okay. Are there policy loans illustrated there? Probably not. Hey, what did by the way, when this all started, fun fact, when this kind of marketing all started back in, I don't know, 17, 18, 19, we were still in zero interest rate land, right? And interest rates continued to stay down relative and dividend scales within companies continued to come down. So dividends, in fact, were lower for these people who started back then. And this is the reason on the whole life insurance mechanic series, again, which I made 2 years ago, I show a letter from one of the big four exactly expressing this point I'm making about annually renewing term. And that the reason was because dividends diverged from what was illustrated when the policy was put in force.
Was there a premium due notice with that?
Yes. It was like they wanted like 8.5% more premium just to cover the annually renewing term.
Increase.
Increase just for that one policy year. And the policy was 4 years old. It's like you've got decades more to go. You've got decades more of dividends doing this compared to what's illustrated on the page.
And so, wait, okay, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to derail you because, my gosh, preach, brother. Annually renewing term, right? So there's a target death benefit. Target death benefit's combination of the base whole life policy death benefit, the dividend death benefit purchased by dividends, right? Dividends paid to cash, PUA. Except for there, it goes first to the term component. All right. If the dividend is lower and it's buying less death benefit and the cost of the death benefit goes up every year, annually renewable term, and you're talking about 1 year that affects every year into the future, you're going to have to carry that term much longer than was illustrated, right? And I get it. The all of the arguments, I mean, I don't know them all. I hear more than I want to hear, and I understand a lot of them that, dividends are going to go up followed by, you know, interest rates. Well, theoretically, yes. If the interest rates go up, then the life insurance company should have, with proper management, have potentially a greater experience in the financial world. This is not a guarantee. What? I'm just saying. So the death benefit's designed to be decreasing the annual renewable term, but it's purchased by the dividend. The dividend's gone down. And so if dividends do follow interest rates, and of course, theoretically, they do, but they're slow follow. They're the tail. Man, interest rates go up tomorrow. Yeah. The banks go up tomorrow on your loans, and then your deposits. The life insurance companies, if they're going to go up, they're going to lag a year, 2 years, or whatever. If they're managed efficiently, right? And most of these companies are. I'm not disparaging any of the company. So, I mean, do you really need an illustration? And this is just one point. And every one of these points, you if you just reason through them, you know, just as a reasonable human being, right, that understands logic, and I'm not disparaging at all. What I'm saying is if there's a decreasing term, but we got to maintain a level death benefit or even an increasing death benefit, that decreasing term or that level death benefit is dependent upon the dividends to the base policy and to the PUA. And then the dividend is allocated to pay the premium on the increasing cost of the decreasing term amount first. Then the remainder goes to the PUA. And every company is a little different, but you can't separate that. You can't get up in the middle of the fourth year because you don't want to pay the additional 8% cost of the increase in that year on the term. You can't call the company and say, hey, can you just carve that, you know, decreasing term off? No, it's blended to the PUA. Well, can I change the dividend election and not have it pay? Can you just bill me separately for the? No, you can't. Oh, wait. And then so now, if you think this through, it's a dividend election, right? And some of them, and it's a dividend decision. Period. You know, you can't change it, even though it's not necessarily an election. But look, Nelson Nash, the first 15 years of his policies. Right, his State Farm, not all of them, to 1959 State Farm policy. The first that he has all of the illustrations for, the chart on in building your warehouse of wealth, right? And if you can find the first edition, please send me a copy because, you know, I've said it many times, it's a point of pride for me. He waited to publish that book to get my acknowledgement in there, you know? Okay, all right. That's the policy I'm talking about, 1959 State Farm policy. The first 15 years, he had the dividend to reduce the premium. Right? Well, look, 1959. Wonder what happened in 1964. He became a life insurance agent. Post-haste, after a little education experience or whatever, his brother is a life insurance agent, he changed the dividend election to the PUA. He knew that the values of that 1959 policy would be at least 20 to 30% greater than what he actually experienced if he didn't have that dividend to reduce the premium in the first 15 years. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So now we have a blended PUA, and the dividend is dedicated to a decreasing term with a guaranteed increase of cost that will never produce a dividend. Mm-hmm. Isn't that just another form of limiting your policy? And yes it is. Yeah. So, but do you need an illustration to prove that?
You could not rely on a depiction of future values in order to address that point.
Okay, do you need an unreliable illustration? Right? I've said it many times, it's inaccurate. When you push print, it's accurate only at the moment that you push print. Once it comes out of the printer, it's inaccurate because everything from that point on is going to change. What you pay in premium, what the dividends are, what the dividends are not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope the answer is no, James. I don't need an illustration that's inaccurate to prove the point. I believe I can reason that through, and it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And that is the end game for all of this style of insurance purchasing, is that they'll just be the results will be much less than what they could have been.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what
it may not be the end of the world, but wait, and he didn't say earlier, you know, these things that change in the future. It is like the Mr. Stock Market guy that comes along and says, oh, well, you know, everybody's down. Look at us. They're down 20. We're only down 15. It's a win. Yeah. What if your health changes?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
What if you go forward 4 or 5 years, you discover, and this is why I'm going to take some actions in the future that I've not taken previously, because I want people to have an opportunity to hear another point that is not, you know, get everything in year one and get a cash on cash soon as possible and go leverage a fire. You hear these things like, well, 100% of your cash value should be leveraged. You should quit. You should shut your door and go home.
Yeah.
Right. Run. And there are agents that say that and people that believe it because I guess the agent was convincing. I don't know. Okay. What if your health changes, right? And you can't fix it. Oh, James, that's a hypothetical. No, I've got case after case case. Yeah. You can't correct it, but you can potentially mitigate it. How about the the companies out there, put it all in. You know, there's a charge to the PUA. Of course you do. If you don't, you should. Which brings me to another point that you brought up that I want to mention too. There's a charge to the PUA when you pay a premium, right? When you pay a premium, there's a charge. And then there's a net amount of premium that's applied to the PUA. Every company. They got to build the, you know, they do the actuarial design on these policies. The engineers that build these things, you know, they've got to do what they've got to do to make a product that they feel good about. What?
You got to pay for all that marketing.
What? Wonder why the first year PUA is so dang high as a percentage on several companies out there.
Not 14, the PUA expense charge.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the first year. Well, that's the year they'll let you pay the most PUA. Well, dang, what a coincidence. All right, and then the other point that I want to tie in, you know, and Ryan eloquently says their words in this contract, and it's unilateral, unbindstrasse. They can't change one thing about it unless they improve it, and most of them don't want to do that. Most of them don't want to add benefits in the future to existing life insurance policies. Some of them will, and then there's, you know, all kinds of reasons why they may be able to or may not be able to, but there are words in there, right, that the illustration has. The illustration is the illustration. It's not the contract, right? All the language on the illustration is not the contract. The life insurance policy is a contract. In their words in English, as he said. And here's my point that I want to make, because I just had a lovely day out with my daughter and all her peeps and there's some fathers, and we're hanging out, and I probably have it regularly all the time. It comes up regularly. When I was young, contracts intimidated me. I don't care if it's a, you know, a contract with the water department, the phone company, or whatever. Contracts intimidated me. I don't know why. You know, today, by God, I can read. You do not have to be an attorney or a life insurance expert to read a contract. You don't have to be an attorney. Now, maybe there's some, you know, interpretation that would help if you have an attorney friend that you can reference or whatever for clarity. The life insurance policy is a contract. You do not have to be an attorney to understand it. You don't. So my encouragement is to read these English words that he talks about.
And then ask questions.
Yeah.
Just ask. The fly-by-night guys won't even answer. So there's your answer there.
Well, they won't give a thorough, you know, in my opinion, I mean, I don't ask them questions, I assure you. I'm not interested. Yeah, I'm not even interested in armchair quarterbacking experts and advisors out there. You have dealt with many times people that have done all these things, have been, you know, drug out down the primrose lane and like, right, thrown into the briar patch, right? You've had conversations. I've had conversations. And so we hear secondhand their conversations and their experiences, yeah, however accurate that they may be. You know, yeah. I mean, I grew up, there's the, you know, three sides to every story, right? Their side, and then the truth.
Yeah.
So I get it. It's secondhand information. And then, so I'll take it with a grain of salt, right? But I often think after a lot of these conversations that it's like, why? You know, and sometimes I ask them when they're really egregious, I'm like, why did you do that? Well, the presentation was so strong.
Yeah.
And I mean good. I'm talking about presented professionally with authority, and it supported, you know, verbally, and it made sense. It was crystal clear. But they didn't know this other information existed. They didn't know Ryan's book was not available yet, but they didn't know his mechanic series was available. They didn't know this podcast was available. They didn't know there's good places for good resources, right? I get it. They're few and far between, in my opinion. They didn't know this book existed. They didn't know Nelson's other work existed. They didn't know Nelson had written,
Building Your Warehouse.
Yeah, but the shorter works that, like, Out of Egypt onto Babylon, essays. They didn't know that some of these essays were available. They didn't know, so they just weren't aware. All right, so they do these things, then they do them. They're thrown off into the briar patch, and they look up, and they don't want to burn it down. And Mr. Griggs isn't going to burn anything down. He's already said, "Bring it on." You know, it's like, I love it. They can't come to you and argue. Wonder why they don't. Not only can they not, right? but I quite frankly think they're intimidated. So they result to, we did win an award, I want you to know, in some of those drive-by comments. The two most arrogant individuals in Infinite Banking. Oh, we did?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was very powerful.
I'll take the, he's arrogant. I've been called that my whole life. I'll take that all day over doing this kind of fake, wishy-washy, fairy dust and unicorns type attitude of
the fake humble stuff, and yeah, it's like here's
the humble,
the regurgitated. The marketing content. I know I'm speaking over you, and I don't want you to lose what you're thinking. The marketing quote unquote content out there. It's like language that has been used for 10, 15, 20 years within the Infinite Banking footprint, right? And then ran through AI, and then put the marketing sprinkle of the fairy dust on there. Here's the unicorn at the end of the rainbow, and it's like keywords, certain powerful truths that are in there. There's no question. Certain names, mention Nelson Nash's name, mention the Infinite Banking concept or becoming your own banker, or closely associated word and verbiage, mm-hmm. And then it's all in humble. It's all I'm just so humble.
Here to help. I just want to help so bad.
Yeah,
I came to this industry to help people. Everybody in finance, right? Why'd you join finance? I just wanted to help so many people. Oh, okay.
There's more people down at the hospital. There's more people down at the food bank. Yeah. If you really want to help, I'm just saying.
Why'd you get a license? Why do you need to set? Publish a blog. What do you mean? Y'all keep it coming. I know. I get it. And I think a lot of times too.
Keep the love coming.
Yeah. I know a lot of these people too that they mistake somebody who's willing to put forth an argument and deploy their own reasoning, they mistake that for acting out of place. And so they need to find something to, smash that down, right? They need to look for the bludgeon or the cudgel that comes in the form of some sort of ad hominem whining type thing. I'm okay with that. If that's the price of being able to be in a business where I can share what I've been taught the way I believe it needs to be and can have enough clients and enough business to keep on going day to day. If that's the price, then it's all good. It really is all good.
In addition to the positive comments, I think I'm going to do, I've thought about it in my mind. I've even sketched a couple out broadly, fundamentally, a broad-based kind of a examples of like a conversational or conceptual case study, because I really don't want to I don't want to be dependent upon illustrations, third-party software. I don't want my clients to be dependent upon that. I don't want my clients to be dependent upon me. I want them to be free and independent. Man, we're here to support you, and you can check the numbers. There's no question. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't use visuals. I'm not saying that. But the idea appeals to me to have a conceptual, conversational case study, all right, where it goes into a little bit more details, more prep work is done. Because here's an example recently, right? Have a client. And they were a refugee, right? Their agent died or went away, and I think he left them. Never met them personally. They had several policies. They think they wanted more. And he mentioned that my name to an agent, so the agent just forthrightly fired him. It's like, oh, if you're going to bring up his name, don't ever call me again. I'm like, wow, how confident is that, right? But I get it, and I understand. No hard feelings, If I can do this, God bless you. So he's been a client several years, had a conversation with him. We're just doing different things We actually have a relationship. We actually have a consulting component as a resource, right? yes, you're thinking correctly here. No, you're not. Or no, I don't even doing that. Well, consider if this is what you're thinking, here are the outcomes or potential mm-hmm. outcomes that you got to consider, other things that you may want to consider, what have you. And he says, oh, by the way, very appreciative. Thank you very much. Was, I'm not going to mention names. He says, James, I work with a lady who has infinite banking policies, but when we talk, I know they're not like mine. Would you talk with her? So I said, sure. And had a conversation. I'm going to have another one. No expectations of anything. You know, I'm doing this because, you know, I like to help her if possible. And I'm honoring the relationship I have with my client. I said I would. I made a commitment, so I'll follow through and do it. And here's, and I don't want to go into detail other than she's a couple of years from retirement. She had four life insurance policies. The week before we had a conversation, she surrendered one. She has three remaining, two years from retirement income, right? She's substantially short on the income needed in her quote unquote retirement. And she, out of the four policies, 4 years old is the oldest policy, right? So she had four, got rid of one, three remain within 4 years. And she has $800,000 in outstanding loans. And she doesn't know which one to surrender first or which one to consider keeping. And 2 years away from passive income. I'm like, what? So I wonder sometimes that, and we had a complete different conversation. It's like, yeah, I'll leave the whatever. It's like, what a powerful presentation. Not saying that she wasn't, you know, a little gullible or, you know, I'm not even making any moral judgments. You know, maybe she's wanting to see something that she, you know, I don't know.
She was sold something.
I mean, how powerful is that PowerPoint? How powerful is that presentation?
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just assuming that it is. You know, it's like we discussed one a couple of weeks ago or several weeks ago, and I think it was part of not a biatical settlement, but a life settlement type situation. And the agent says, I will not correspond with you anymore. Don't call me. Don't email me.
Right.
And all they want is legitimate answers to legitimate questions.
Which he couldn't give, right? Because the basis of the sale in the first place was misleading. So there's not going to be a good answer later. So it's just sell it. What are you whining about? Just sell it.
And just pay the premium, right?
Yeah. What are you coming to me with your problems for, is the attitude.
Like, I'm done. I'm gone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But I'm the one that's arrogant, right? Yeah. Look, I come out and tell you what I think. These other people tell you what they think you need to hear to get you to say yes. And then they go carry all of their other real opinions with them behind closed doors.
Ooh.
Yeah. Because it's all about salesmanship. Like, that's what this is. It's like, how can we sell the product? There's no strategic conversation. And insurance agents have such a terrible reputation anyway. I get it. And no one knows really what a financial advisory conversation looks like or what a real financial strategy even means. That sounds so amorphous. It sounds like jargon meant to make people sound stupid. No, it's like you need to take into consideration the idea of late life passive cash flow. I mean, this is kind of unrelated, but I always see these things on X, Twitter, about how, you know, so-and-so expert says now you need to have X amount of money to live comfortably in retirement. And it's like, everyone's got a different number, right? It's like, wow, how you all have different numbers. And every time I see one of these, I'm like, how silly. The idea that in a fiat monetary system with fractional reserve banking, that you're going to depict in your mind any particular number. I don't care what the particular number is. And that's going to be good enough. Like, no, you don't need a certain amount at a certain time. One needs a system that can continue to produce increasing amounts over time.
What?
And how big, how large is that number? As big as it's going to be. right? As big as your income and your premium payment can cause it to become. And that's what we'd want anyway. You know, it's another one of these like conventional financial things that floats around that people just grab out of the ether and say, oh, that's a good idea. You know, and then all the other noise comes along too. I have these questions that people, it's always an indication of people getting wandering off into the noise. Should I put the policy in a trust? Should I put the policy in the business? You know, I'm going to play some sort of tax game. And I've got a bookkeeper, an accountant with letters after his name who thinks life insurance is kin to the devil. And so we need to play some sort of game with it, right? I'm going to put it in a trust. I'm going to put it in a business. I'm going to write it off. One, no, you're not, right? There's going to be a tax liability somewhere. Premiums paid to cash value, permanent whole life insurance are not. They may be tax deductible to the business. They're going to be taxable as gross income to the individual. Not an advisor, but that's what it is. Not a tax advisor, but that's what it is. Putting a policy in a trust. I don't know what. Okay, if it's a lawyer, I mean, God bless lawyers because they need it, right? But trusts pay tax. Where is this idea that if I put an asset in a trust, I'm magically saying, okay, the income paid to the asset that's held in the trust is therefore not income to you and therefore excludable from your personal gross income. It's still income to the trust, and the trust is going to pay taxes. And go ahead and look up on the IRS's site what the trust income tax rates are. You think personal income tax rates are punitive? They are worse for trusts. The top tax bracket kicks in after like 12 or 13 grand in income to the trust. It's not like tax goes away. You're not eliminating tax liability. You are shifting it from a relatively favorable personal environment to a relatively unfavorable trust environment. And then let's not even talk about how you're going to get the policy loans. Trust assets are supposed to be used for the benefit of the beneficiary. So now it's the beneficiary that's got to request a loan. And then the beneficiary is going to loan you, the primary person, the money. And then when you go back to undo all that, then you, the primary person, have to repay the beneficiary who then repays the policy that's held in the trust. It's like, what are you adding except increased tax liability to do all that? It's just more of this half-baked marketing idea of let's tell you to do something, and that something is going to involve me getting paid, right? I'm the lawyer, so I'm going to get paid to put the trust in place, or the business advisor, the business consultant's going to help you set up a business. Yeah, go ahead and put the policy in. Go ahead and, you know, your own self, pierce the corporate shield. Go ahead and expose that policy to litigants and the IRS and whomever else may come after business assets. For what? So you can be restricted on the use of loans? It's becoming, I said this before, it sounds glib, it's becoming your own. You is in the title. Your own. You be the owner. You be the banker. And then if you happen to have a trust that needs need for capital, lend it the money. You got a business that needs money? Lend it the money. You be the owner. Dividend paying whole life is best treated from a tax perspective, best treated from a asset protection perspective when held personally.
So in most states.
You be the owner.
it's the idea, or the fact that these beautiful presentations here lately, I know if you look at something too long on all the algorithms, you get, you know, that's what you get fed for, seems like forever. You know, I'm going to snooze them, put them on 30-day pause or whatever they are. They just seem to never go away, or they're like zombies and Night of the Living Dead. They just keep coming. the LLC, the LLC here do this, and this is how I hold my assets, and there's like a schematic there, but
yeah, graph,
it's quick. it's you know, very concise. And it's authoritarian sounding, very knowledgeable, looks complicated, so it must be good. you see that with the universal life, you know, they don't even show illustrators, show numbers up there. If you'll pay this and this and this for this many years, you'll have this much in income. wow, that leaves so much out. I mean, other than, but of course, there's nothing really to do in those type of situations, I think, is to, you know, click on something to go learn more, to schedule a call or whatever. And then you get the calendar, right? Here's my calendar. You want to hop on a call and a discovery call for 20 minutes? Anyway.
It's actually a good point on. Sorry.
No, I mean, they're just beautiful presentations until you start dissecting them at a minimal amount.
Yeah.
And then it's like you don't even have dust. You're not even picking up dust, you know?
Yeah, so it just occurred to me, too. You know, the reason that all of these, like, major financial house-financed media outlets, like CNBC and Bloomberg and all them, that, you know, all get paid the advertising dollars from Fidelity, State Street, or Main Street, whatever it's called, BlackRock, all these. And then they pump out these articles about you need X or you need Y amount by age 65. Okay, maybe it's a conspiracy theory, but it's awfully convenient, right, that there's this appearance of this outside third-party materials telling you how much you need at a specified date in the future, because that becomes the input to the marketing system for you, right? Oh, you, such and such age, such and such income, you know, look at this ostensibly third-party media piece that tells you you need Y amount of money at Z age, right? So that's going to be our target. And now we can impute how much you need to put into the tax qualified plan or the stock market index, which we're then going to assume grows at a certain mythological
rate.
So
many assumptions there,
right?
Beyond just the rate of return.
And you're going to live in a, you know, tax rates are going to go down in the future, LOL, and you're going to be in a lower bracket in the future. And all these assumptions, that it's an ingredient to the sales funnel, is what I'm saying. The idea that a fixed amount in the future, that gives the consumer a target to look at, right? It gives the salesman something to point at and say, here, Mr. Consumer, look at this number that Bloomberg told you about. This is the number now we're going to plan around. We're going to impute from that number how much you need to contribute to this stock market. So it's just a component of the broader sales system, right? All of that has to be, you have to see, you don't have to do anything, do what you want, but I would invite you to understand this as part of a system to encourage you to separate yourself from control over your capital. That's all it is, right? Instead, the idea, the suggestion, the encouragement from Nelson is to embrace the opportunity to take ownership over the entire system itself, rather than becoming a part of a system that is sold to you. Own the system yourself. And if you do that, if you make that paradigm shift, everything should change. It shouldn't be how little can I get away with in contributing year to year. No. How much can I possibly contribute year to year? For how long can I do that? How do I retain the most exacting control over when I pay and how much I pay? How can I prevent, to the greatest extent possible, the industry from telling me no when it comes time to expand my system in the future? That's the case, by the way, for convertible term. Whole separate thing. The whole mindset shifts when you go from being a consumer of manufactured opportunities presented to you as different potential investments to becoming an owner of your own system. It's the another word in the title, own. You own it, right? In control. Everything should shift. And so trying to get away with paying with building as little of a foundation as possible and pay as little of a base premium as possible because I want the system to serve me as little as possible for as short amount of time as possible. No. How much base premium can I stand given my need for early liquidity or for early liquidity? Right? What company should I work with? What company should I choose in order to acquire a policy where the exercise of my contractual rights does not result in a reduction in my residual claimancy, where a use of policy loans does not result in additional penalties to my dividends? What company might I work with? What term writer might I select with as few moving parts as possible so that I can accomplish the goal of preserving my preferable tax favorable non-MEC status while also paying premium for as long as possible. Do you see how the mindset shifts? Right? If you're looking at it from a system owner with a long-term perspective, all of these things should change. The attitude to the amount of premium, the attitude to the premium structure, the attitude to company selection, the attitude towards recognition treatment, the attitude towards the type of term writer. All of that should shift. It's implied within the idea of owning if one is really serious about owning. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe we're not being serious about wanting to own and control the banking function. Maybe it's just about facilitating the sale on the spot. You've got some money in the bank. You just can't stand all that liquidity. Need to put it somewhere. And so let's go get the big old 1090 with my dump in. And look, I got guys online with numbers on a page. They can show me that it can happen. I really can do it. They're really encouraging and convincing. So I'll just go do that, right? And the people out there who are willing, excited, cannot help themselves but to indulge that short-term minded fight or flight attitude are part of the problem. And you don't think, you know, you shall know a tree by its fruit, but the tree don't grant fruit right away. It's going to take some time. So it's going to take some time for all that to fall apart. It's going to take some time for that to look a lot different than what was originally shown to you in the first place. But you can bet in that DocuSign portal where you signed 85 ways to Sunday, you put your initials next to every freaking disclosure that was required so that when you want to go back and hire a lawyer to punish somebody, you can bet that everybody has fully covered their rear end. And you're the one holding the bag. Oh, but it's all fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Yeah, okay. Keep up with that. Keep up with the non sequitur. Keep up with the ad hominem. That's fine. This for those who are seeking to understand this kind of discussion, this type of argument is going to remain available. Just know that if it's appealing to you, if it's attractive to you, if you ultimately take action with me or with James or somebody else, again, do what you want. Just know that you will be in the minority. And so you should expect that the noise will continue. You should expect to continue to feel as though you're doing something different. You should expect to have these people. I had a current client tell me this, you know, that he's the one responsible for these three or four restaurants and the two warehouses and the food prep that he's got going on, generating all this revenue year to year. But all the people with the letters after his name in his life are coming at him, asking him, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Why didn't you do this? And so he's eyeballs deep in the noise. And I had to tell him, is it interesting how they're the ones coming at you challenging what you're doing and you haven't even given a second, not even a first thought to challenging what they're doing? Isn't that interesting that the flow of the criticism comes at you? Huh? Why would that be? Yeah. May have to do with their own lack of self-confidence, with their own low self-esteem with respect to whatever it is they're doing, may have to do with their own need to go find confirmation, to go find validation, to go find affirmation, to get you, the one who's perceived to be doing something different, to bend, to give in, to say, oh, no, no, what I've been doing is wrong. You, Mr. Critic, you're right. You're so right. Here's your validation nicely wrapped up for you. Maybe not. Maybe they're just curious and everybody's got intentions pure as the driven snow. I don't know. By the way, it doesn't matter, right? Because they're going to continue to come. They're going to continue to criticize. So just expect that and remember that you own all of this. So what other people have to say doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They get to go have their, go, everybody go do what you want. Right? Free association, live and let live. All right. Yes, I'm going to go pay my policy. I have three that I built and designed for myself. I own five, but three that I built and designed where I'm the insured. 40-60 in structure. More base premium than the little system, the little software, little auto solve software would have told me I needed. Right? That's what these agents are doing, by the way. The software, you know, they've rigged the software. No, no. The life insurance companies have figured out that the agents don't care to understand their product. And so they told the vendor that creates the software, put a little button in there that says auto solve based to PUA so that the agent can click the button and put in 10 and 90. And then it spits out the system that the illustration system says that will be minimally sufficient given the current experience of the company to get done whatever is being put into that software. That's what's happening here. Okay. Well, people went away and squirreled away and figured out the software. No. None of these, precisely zero of these other financial entertainment platforms are talking about the Society of Actuaries Modified Endowment Contracts textbooks. Okay. They're not dissecting the actuarial math. Okay. Come on. They're not going and addressing the underlying infrastructure of these policies from a mathematical perspective. And everybody who wants to do something that looks like that goes to Excel, right? They're going to fabricate out of their own, you know, expertise how these policies perform, right? None of them are going to go actually and look at the net single premium test and the guideline single premium test and look at published mortality tables and look at the bulletins published by the SOA or any of their textbooks, all of which you can buy. They're not doing that. Okay, no. This is just what they're.
It's too much truth here, bro.
They're just punching into the software that the companies knowingly stupefy to make easy enough to get these nice little clever systems that line up with their sales systems, because that's what IBC is to these people, just a sales and marketing system, so that the agent's got something to put in front of you so you can say yes. That's what's really going on here. Okay, and you're going to wrap that up and call it, you know, IBC, fine. And then you're going to, you know, whine and complain when I say that IBC is more than that. It's a financial philosophy. It's a lifestyle. You've got to consider the long term. It's not just semantics. You mentioned something earlier. We haven't talked about it. You know, there's more than one dividend paid to a whole life policy, right? There's a trade-off between the degree to which a premium dollar contributes to financial performance at the company and liquidity. Okay, so if a base premium dollar is paid to a company, base premium dollars are relatively illiquid, meaning there's relatively less cash value growth associated with them. And so the company is responsible.
In the early years.
So just early on, right? Dollar of base premium, no cash value, dollar PUA premium, big old cash value. There's a trade-off there, right? The two premium dollars are not contributing to company surplus to the same degree, right? If I pay a PUA premium dollar, if the vast majority of that PUA premium dollar is going to generate cash value, that is a potential liability to the company. The company is bound to offer you a policy loan up to the amount of cash value, and so that's a potential draw on liquidity to the company. And that potential draw on liquidity to the company is a cost, and that means that that premium dollar is not going to contribute as much to financial surplus at the company than is the relatively less liquid base premium dollar.
What?
So if you squish your base premium down as close to zero as possible and you blow up the PUA as much as possible, you are expanding the premium that contributes the least to the company's financial performance, and you are squishing down the one that contributes most to the smallest degree. And the result will be this tiny little bitty trickle of dividends. And when you get 30, 40, 50 years out into the future, when the greatest contributing factor to ongoing cash value growth is the dividend, and you've got this little bitty base premium, and you're thinking, oh, I've had compounding, so who cares how big the dividends were? I'm going to enjoy cash flow to be able to survive in my late years on this policy. Just know that taking that anti-base premium, big old PUA approach is the opposite of the way to do that. Dividends are greater in connection with base premium. If you were really thinking long-term, one would account for that in choosing the premium design today. But again, that doesn't fit well into the digital sales system from the nice, cool, humble.
Again, for the third angelic time, there's a lot there. You know, you mentioned banker there finally, and thank you on the title. What are we really doing? You know, you're just paying premium because you got all that money in the at the bank, and the interest rates are going up and not high enough. And so get it all into policy first. I mean, becoming your own banker, it's solving, controlling the banking function in your life. people have generally, I mean, the general population have no idea what that could possibly mean to them and their progeny, their future generation. I mean, they just don't. And so it's difficult, and they don't want to go deep sometimes. You know, they don't want to watch an hour podcast or listen to an hour video or anything like that. So just let's just talk about the dividend, right? Well, 6%, 5.5%. Oh, what's the guaranteed interest rate on the cash value? Oh, just give me some simple numbers, and I can do some really simple math, and then show me a big illustration that supports, you know, the half-truths that are being conveyed from the, you know, expert to the unsuspecting American population. And it's like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. Solving the banking function changes your financial life if you can do it. And it, you know, it takes a solid foundation and some time, some education, some experience through application. But it's worth it. I mean, it is so worth it. And then, do I care what the interest rates are? No. I've said it before. The interest rates right now, we've come out of a 15-year artificially suppressed low interest rate environment. The guys in the home office have never experienced that. Very few of them have. The ones that have already retired. Mm. I mean, why are you saying something like that, James? Because what Ryan just wound up with there on what attributes the most to the capital surplus of a company. Right? Think about this. I'm a big four company, and I live or die on this age-old argument in the life insurance industry on dividend rates. I pay 6% dividend. Okay. Well, no wonder, like, if you have access to 90% of the cash values, and I get it, they have a dynamic or variable loan rate, but I got to pay the chump salesman, right? The huckster or whatever, and I don't want to be too disparaging, but I want to be honest, right? Of course, everybody knows agent gets paid, and so you're paying them. There's a cost to setting up, putting in force a policy to the company that goes way beyond commissions. You know, they have all the real estate, the money managers, the service people and all that. Their profitability on a policy is way out in the future. And then they can't lower the dividend because of who they are, right? And so talk about spread compression. Mm-hmm. All of the costs are baked. You know why? Do you know, have you ever considered why there's less liquidity in the early years of a whole life insurance policy? It's not because they pay the commission to the agent, all of that money. Do they pay the commission to the agent? Of course they do. If you want to work with somebody who's altruistic, you know, there's a food bank down the road. I don't know. Capitalists like profits. They need profits. So you can't have profits, capitalism without profits. Very long. Okay. So I'm going to live or die on this dividend because it's a very old argument. We pay this of who we are. We can't reduce the dividend. No, they can't reduce the dividend because the amount of policies that they put in force on an average annual basis is baked into the cost of their product at engineering time. Okay. And then how many policies lapse also baked into the engineering process. But then I'm going to charge you a 5.7 loan rate, right? On this, the majority of this cash value that you can borrow against, and the obligation of the death benefit is there. That's the primary obligation of the life insurance company, is to fulfill every guarantee that's wrapped up in that contract. Future death benefit, future cash values, if you get mad and quit, the guaranteed cash values, right? So I'm going to pay a 6% dividend, and I'm only going to charge you a 5.7% loan rate, and I'm going to pay the schmuck and all of the admin, and yeah, no wonder they don't like it. Even though I think they're smooth jumping over the fact that those policies aren't going to deliver the death benefit that they're on the hook for anyway. And yeah, I get it, the net amount at risk and all that. I mean, you can go pretty deep into that, but you don't necessarily, in my opinion, have to go very deep into why the companies don't like that, right? And I'm not a shill for the life insurance companies. I'm just explaining. You got all of this money that you've got to pay a dividend on, and you got to have it perform sufficiently to meet the future guarantees. There's a spread compression to these life insurance companies. Oh, well, we'll give them some relief. We got a rising interest rate environment. I'm just saying that there's a little bit more.
There's no free lunch.
Behind, especially not in the financial world. There's a reason companies build the products that they do, you know, make the illustration software easy. You know, they figured out that, oh, that's the game within the infinite banking footprint. So we'll make it easy for the agent who can't build his own illustration anyway, that has to rely on the home office. They killed two birds with one stone, right? Okay, so here we'll make it really simple for the life insurance agent, and then therefore we don't have to deal with him on the service end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Anywho, and you can bet the actuary, the actuary that built the policy, and then the third party individuals that built that software, right? That the company pays a license to come in there and manage all the bugs every 90 days or every 6 months. Yeah, them. And the people up there at the home office of the life insurance company, all the officers and all of the senior vice presidents and the managers and all of them. You think how many, my question is, gets down to how many of them do you think have read this book more than one time, more than a cursory review? How many of them do you think are with intent and purpose, like trying to control the banking function in their life? Those are the people that are building the software for the agent to spit out an illustration that you'll say yes to. Yeah, well, what could possibly go wrong there? I'm just asking. That's a legitimate question. So that was really, man, I was so entertained today. I'm not kidding. I'm glad you drove down here. And, like, which I'm always entertained, but sometimes it's just funner than others, you know.
All right.
Anything else? You need some barbecue, man?
That sounds phenomenal. Yeah.
Look, I had fun. Thank you for listening. Look forward to seeing you.
Have a good day, y'all.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.